Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, you're
listening. Blog Talk Radio.
Yes. You're listening to another edition of Religion Means Alive. Yes, we are alive today, and I'm glad to be reaching my brothers and sisters. We have many things. First, I want to give a live welcoming to our live audience. Peace be unto you, peace with you, blessings of peace, hope, prosperity, and all the blessings with you. We're having a special edition of Religion Means Alive today, and I know I can't wait to get into it. It saddens me to actually discuss this issue, but it's a much needed issue. I'm waiting for the callers to get in right now. I already see you lined up. Many people out here are in tune for this show we have doing today. This show today is under the banner of culture.
Hello. Assalamu alaikum.
Can you hear me, my dear brother?
Yes, I hear you now.
Yes, sir. I was asking, what is your current project? I understand you now have a collection of pictures of the Imam W.D. Muhammad. We're going to discuss that. Tell us about that collection. I was trying to download it for review, and since I'm have to play the role of Ray Charles today, haven't seen it. Tell us what that's all about.
Well, I had the opportunity in 75 to a series of photographs. I was working for, let's say, it was still Muhammad Speaks at that time. And I had an opportunity to cover Imam Muhammad's activities during the transition, the early part. And over the years, I've had an opportunity to photograph and have a number of conversations with Imam Muhammad. So I've, a couple of years ago, I started putting some of those photographs together as a separate collection, just remembering Imam Muhammad. I think it was, I can't remember which year now. I think 99 or 2000. I did a publication called Thanks for the Memories. And I took a number of photographs from Imam Muhammad's achievements and produced sort of a magazine, more of a magazine than a book. But and then this is really an expansion of that. There are a number of photographs that are previously not published. One that I think I saw a copy of it on the internet recently was Imam Muhammad in the long white robe that he wore, I believe, only one time. And I happened to be at Juma for that occasion. And those photographs were, one of those photographs was published, I think, in Bilalian News at the time. And then from that point on, he expressed his displeasure with wearing those kind of iconic methods of clothing. And he never put that robe on again. And I did, like I said, have copies of that photograph. As I'm thinking about it now, there are a number of other photographs that don't appear in this publication that I'll probably have to do a volume two to cover those.
Do you know why, Senator, why he didn't want those pictures, that particular picture to be published?
He had a number of unique requests when it came to publication of materials and pictures, and sometimes he would explain, and sometimes he'd just tell us not to use it. I know after we got past, I believe, 1978, he cautioned us against using materials that he early on during his tenure as leader of the community. He said that he had refined those teachings and explanations and didn't want us reverting to those comments and statements from the earlier period of time. But I have a few of those handwritten comments too regarding some items to be published and some not, some to be edited and some not. And then 78, there was also we did extensive coverage on his Atlanta speech, and then there was a portion of that speech that he advised us not to not to publish. He reviewed it and then instructed us not to publish. But now his instructions were, usually came in the form of requests. So technically we could say he requested that we didn't do it, but we knew that his request was, was a directive. But he would put his directive in the form of request. But for those of you who want to have a look at the publication, you can see a preview of it, and it's available for purchase. I'll give you the short version of the website. Wali Akbar's album is to it by going to BIT, that's Baker Indio, T for Tom, and then by dot, and then DO, that's Delta Oscar, and then put a slash WDM for Warth Dean Muhammad. So bit.do/WDM in your browser, and that'll take you to the website where you can get a look at a few of the images that are inside. And it starts off with an explanation of how I came to meet Imam W.D. Muhammad. I actually met him. I was introduced to him by his mother at the dinner table at the at Elijah Muhammad's home in Washington, D.C., 1122 Staples Street. I had occasion to be on an escort detail for Sister Clara Muhammad. In the, that would have been the latter 60s, 1968, 69, when she came to D.C. on a visit. And a unique opportunity to sit with her on several mornings at the breakfast table. And it was kind of funny. I was there to drive her around and just to to basically be to see that she got where she needed to go and so forth. I saw it as kind of a security operation. I was downstairs when she came down for breakfast. And I was on post, my arms folded, at the door in the kitchen that opened to the side yard to protect her if somebody was to advance on the door, so to speak. And she looked at my military stance and she said, brother, are you going to have something to eat?
Hey, you didn't kill her mother's instinct with all of your military postures, huh? No, ma'am, sister, I'm going to eat one meal every other day.
What? And that was our that was our mantra in D.C. at that time. One, I think we ate like three or four meals a week. And when I explained that I didn't plan on eating anything and maybe wouldn't eat that day at all, she said in a calm fashion, she said, brother, my husband says if you have something important to do during the day and have a meal early in the morning, it doesn't have to be a heavy meal, but you should have a meal early in the morning to carry you through your important task during that day. So what do you think my husband would say if you were driving me around and you felt lightheaded because you haven't had anything to eat all day? So I said, yes, Sister Clara, thank you very much. I told the sister in the kitchen, I think it was Sister Lucille, I'll have the soft scrambled eggs, I'll have the whole wheat toast, I'll have the orange juice, I'll have the grits. And I was able to...
Hey, I'm glad you were not one of those holy brothers that wouldn't have picked... Now, some brothers at that time wouldn't have picked an instruction. Well, half even had come from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. They had their own mind.
Well,
that was a hint to the wise that was sufficient.
Dr. Shabazz had us in that holy sense. He had us in that sanctified state of mind. I remember going to the Salam restaurant and seeing white sugar in the bowl on the counter at the Salam restaurant and taking offense with the brother who was serving. Said, "Well, brother, why is this white sugar on the table?" But in D.C. we were really scientific. We could have a whole meal out of beans. You know, we could have bean soup, we could have bean salad, we could have a vegetable plate consisting of several different kinds of beans. And we even had some bread made out of beans, I think. We had some double-cooked bread made out of whole wheat flour and I think some bean powder, some ground-up bean powder. And we even went to the extreme of having bean ice cream.
Wow!
And I remember, I mean, I was past my... my days of being a total scientist by the time we had the bean ice cream. And I remember Dr. Shabazz went to Chicago to meet with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he would always come back and he would share his notes with us. But he wouldn't share all the notes at one time. He would dole them out. So you got to hear a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. And It was always interesting in the minister's class when he came back. And he went to Chicago and announced that we had that we were able to make bean ice cream in D.C. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's response to that was, brother. I wouldn't eat no cold beans.
Brother, I tell you, we have really survived the war of Armageddon, haven't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me how, continue telling us, you meeting Imam Muhammad, and you were there in Washington, D.C., at the home of Sister Clara Muhammad, who was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Benjamin Muhammad, who had been the founding member, I believe, of the Washington Temple number 4, and go on to tell us the occasion that you met Imam Wahbuddin Muhammad.
Well, I was actually introduced to him by Sister Clara, who, during those breakfast conversations he had, raised the question that she couldn't understand why her son couldn't accept the Savior, and it troubled her that he didn't accept to find W.D. Farad as a line person.
Mm-hmm.
That was. He said, "No, I don't understand. That's how he got his name. That's all that he has, is contingent upon the Savior, and he just doesn't accept to say that the Savior is Allah." And I can't understand. I've seen him at odds with his father over this. I've seen him turn down a sizable amount of cash that he would have had as a member. And she talked, I think, for quite a while about the fact that the Imam didn't see or didn't accept to see W.D. Farad as he was portrayed by his father. And later on, I heard the Imam explain part of that when he was in, I think he was in Miami doing a question and answer session in Miami after Juma. He just sat on the floor with the believers and just took questions for, I think, about 2 hours.
Wow.
Any questions that believers had, I was present when he did that in Boston. I think in Boston, there were a number of believers who found out he was in town and just came to the masjid when he found that there were 30 or 40 or 50 believers in the Musala, then he said, "Well, Brother Imam, I'd like to go down and talk with the believers." So he came down and sat on the stage and the believers sat on the rug, and he just took questions. He just allowed the believers to just open up whatever was on their mind. He allowed them to ask, and he answered the question. But in Miami, during that question and answer period, he explained that by reading the Quran in Arabic, he understood that W.D. Farad was not Allah in person, and that he talked about his situation where W.D. Farad had visited their home when he was a real small child, it had been recited to him, so he knew the incident as if he was present. But he said Master Farad came to their home in Hamtramck, Michigan, and he asked his older brother where his father was. And he said, now, if you pay strict attention to what's going on here, he said, if W.D. Farad was the omnipotent God in person, he certainly wouldn't have had to come to our home and ask my older brother where his father was. He would have known.
That's right.
It would have been no question. He said, then he went on to say that even though he was of this knowledge, he didn't challenge or dispute his father publicly because it would have tended to undo the work that his father was doing. His father was in earnest doing a great work and doing it in honesty and sincerity. And he had been in the company of his father and Islamic scholars who had not challenged his father. And he said, now I know these folks are much greater knowledge of Islam than I am, being the scholars that they are. And I'm only a student, you know, a young student at that. And he said, these people didn't challenge my father. And he said, it had to have been that it was an effort not to upset, that even though he was in error in representing that, W.D. Farad was a lying person, that they felt that the good he was doing far outweighed the error, and that the error could be corrected at some point when it was time to disturb the work that his father was doing. But I'm trying to pull a copy of the book up on. See that I have my phone plugged in the wall because I don't want the battery to run out. And
yes, sir. We don't run out. That would be the equivalent of a major bill for our minister running out of something to talk to the lost found. And we could turn the lost, and hopefully we'll found today. I want to ask you, then, when did you physically meet Imam Wallace, then Minister Wallace Imam? You met him while he was the minister at Temple Number 2, or did you meet him in Washington while his mother was there in Washington?
No, just the just her introduction to him and her comments about him is what I learned in D.C. when I came out to.
What year was that?
That would have been, I believe, 1967.
So that was weighing heavily on Sister Clara Muhammad's mind. This favorite son, when I said favorite son, it was always known that he would be the leader, or was supposed to help his father. That's been very disturbing to her, for her to have brought this up in the privacy of. And she obviously thought enough of you that you were not a spook, even though you were ready to eat bean ice cream and wouldn't eat a meal while you were on this important assignment. She saw in you a profound faith because, you know, one thing we learned in the Nation of Islam was wisdom. We knew who to expose teachers to. Certain things we weren't exposed to a believer that would cause that person to lose faith. We were very careful about that. But she
right.
went to the head. Sense that you, even though you were a top-notch scientist in the sense of eating one every other day and three times a week, you still had rationality about you and had questions that you would ask. But I know I've been in the company of some of the top officials. One brother come around and he said, brother, we're going to close this discussion out. We're not going to talk around that brother. And not that they didn't like that brother, but they knew that brother could not handle the discussion that that brother might would desire to handle. Any
right.
comments on
Well, mashallah, I'm happy that she was, you know, and I hadn't looked at it in that sense, but I'm happy that that she was saw enough in me to actually invite me to the table and then to discuss these matters together.
Who else was at that table at that time?
It's just the two of us.
Oh, wow.
It was a small breakfast table in the kitchen. It was like a breakfast nook. It wasn't there was a dining room, but she didn't take her breakfast in the dining room.
Oh.
Opted to eat in the kitchen.
And just with
and,
you?
Yeah, I'm the only one. You know, now that I'm thinking back on it, that was really an honor at that time because, well, I had really embarrassed myself no end the night before because Sister Lucille had given me a camera. They had a big dinner for her. There were two tables in the dining room. You had the minister and she sat at the minister's table, and then there was another table for the wives and other folks who were present. And Sister, I was back and forth in and out of the kitchen and so forth, and Lucille handed me a camera. It wasn't during the time I was taking pictures seriously. I don't even know if she knew how I knew to operate a camera. But she handed me a camera, asked me, she said, brother, I'd like to have a picture of Sister Clara. Would you take one for me? Because I'm working here in the kitchen, and I've got on, my hands are full of food and so forth and so on. She handed me a camera. And it was one of those little Instamatic cameras with the ones that had the four flash bulbs on the side. And when you pushed the button, there was like a monster flash of lightning going on. And just trying to oblige, I took the camera. I went out between the tables there and I stooped down and got almost eyeball to eyeball with Sister Clara, and when she turned to look, I guess, to see what I was doing stooping down between the table, the button on the camera, and I filled the room with light, blinding light, so to speak, and I had not asked her permission or the minister's permission or anybody else's permission. I just took the camera, went in and took a picture. And there was this, the room filled with light. And then as the light dimmed down and the room looked black because there wasn't, it sucked all the light out of the room, so to speak. Then there was this enormous gasp that came from 30 or 40 people that were in the room. And I'm stooping down there on one knee. Now I'm wishing I could turn into a little nut and roll under the table. but I had to swallow my embarrassment and rise to my feet and then turn slowly and walk back to the kitchen. So I had thoroughly embarrassed myself in front of her the night before. So I guess the idea of, I have no idea. Maybe it was the manner in which I accepted her invitation to have a meal which, you know, that could have been a test question.
I can imagine had that been some lieutenant wanting to get ranked, what he would have done with your young FOI hide.
Oh, man. Yeah, I got a lot of that.
They were very merciful people, contrary to the people that worked under them. You know, what we got from the Honorable Muhammad, what we got from Sister Clara Muhammad was quite different. I never had the privilege of meeting her, but those who told me that had been around her verify exactly the manner of what you were talking about. At what point did you meet the Imam Wahidin Muhammad, then Minister Wallace?
In 1969, I came out and took some pictures of the parade, and then I got a press card. And 1970, when I came to Saviour's Day, we were there a little early for an education meeting. I was one of the teachers at the school in D.C. And we were there for an education meeting. Following the education meeting, we went down to John Ali gave us a tour of the Muhammad Speaks building, which had been purchased in 69. This was 1970. But I had a press card, so when I came to the convention, cameras into the convention, and sort of separated myself from everybody else at number four and went right down front and set up to take some pictures. And in the course of taking those photographs, this was the year that it was revealed to the nation that Washington, D.C. had a number of Muhammad Speaks newspapers kept in a garage.
Was Imam Muhammad in good standing at that time?
Let me see. No, not at the point when I came out there. So what happened was, as a result of taking those pictures at the convention, when we had this embarrassing incident at the end, I excused myself from the hall because I didn't want to be caught up in the shame, the finger pointing of shame, and so I left without the norm. I didn't leave as all the other photographers and everybody else did, because there was. The officials were actually collecting the film from everybody who had taken pictures at the convention. So all the photographers, reporters, and so forth turned in their film, and then I went out to the Salam restaurant to have something to eat. And I also had arranged permission to attend the temple meeting in Chicago, because I've been part of the nation for almost 10 years and I hadn't been to a meeting in Chicago. So I wanted to go to the temple in Chicago. So I got permission to stay over and go to the meeting. And when I got up to the salon, there was a message for me to call Hassan
Shuri. Some of us who might not remember that, some who don't know much about the nation's history, may not understand why you had to have permission to travel. We weren't free to travel from one temple to another. Just set that scenario up before you go ahead with the story.
Okay.
Because a lot of people wouldn't understand, what do you mean get the permission to go to another temple?
This came about actually because of Washington, D.C. again. There was an enterprising reporter for the Washington Post named Wallace Terry, I believe was his name. And what he had done was he had been out to Chicago and attempted to interview the Honorable Elijah Muhammad for a series of articles on the Nation of Islam. And he was refused the interview, or he wasn't successful in gaining the interview. I don't know whether he was refused or just it didn't work out. But while he was there in Chicago, he went to the temple a couple of times, and he kind of got the feel of what was going on at the temple. So he came back to Washington. He bought a suit and a skinny red tie and attended the temple in D.C. without being a member. He pretended to be a member from Chicago. So he was allowed to attend the temple. He was allowed, I think, to even attend the FOI class. So he was able to gain information for the Washington Post for these series of articles in the Post that came about under the guise of being a member of the Nation of Islam from another temple. So from that point on, when those articles came out and it was learned how he was able to do this, from that point on, you had to have permission. You had to have what's called a travel letter.
That's right, yeah.
And you got a letter signed by your local minister indicating that you were actually a member in the city.
And
where
don't
you
forget,
were a member.
In good standing. Because there were a
yeah,
lot
you
of
had
members.
To be, you were a member in good standing.
That's right, because that means that you were. Explain to us what it means to be in good standing as to be in Class C and Class F.
Well, good standing was the fact that you were an able-bodied member of the FOI, and good standing meant that you had, that you were regularly donating, that you carried out whatever tasks were assigned you, and that later on, when we started selling Muhammad Speaks newspapers with a quota, that you had taken care of your quota of papers. And let's see, around that time in the late 60s, the quota was 300 papers for each FOI in good standing. If you didn't get to your 300 papers, you would wind up in Class C. Now, Class C was, you were still in good standing, but you were restricted in terms of what you could do. You couldn't hold a post that was in prominence. You couldn't stand a post in front of the rostrum. You couldn't. What else could you do? I think that was about it. You couldn't have a high-profile post that stood you out front as an example of the FOI for other people.
Right. It was called being a watchful eye of the mob's officials.
Right. Now, if you were in Class C, the older brothers or senior brothers were in Class C under normal circumstances because they were not expected to be out front. They were not expected to shoulder full responsibility of the FOI in terms of that. So your quota of papers was in 125 papers as opposed to 300. And also, as a member of Class C, you were responsible to show up at the temple and expect to be the one that put the chairs away, that swept the floor, that cleaned up, that did other menial tasks around the temple that the lieutenants would have fun devising different tasks and chores for you. So if you're in Class C, you could still travel, I believe.
Yeah, you could travel.
But you had to be in good standing. You had to be in good standing in Class C.
That's right.
If you were in Class F, which was fuel for the fire.
That's right. That's exactly right. You were really a bad stand. You were not allowed in the restaurant, not in saving space. You were basically a member. You were just in prison almost as far as the nation. This time you were exiled. Let me ask
you. Yeah,
you
were exiled. You were exiled. We were not to have any dealings with anybody who was in Class F.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So if you had a business, we weren't to do business. We weren't to show up at your business if you were in Class F.
That's right. That's exactly right. A lot of brothers went out of business when they came into Class F because the temple was boycotting.
Right. And in those days, if you were, remember we you had to be a certain weight in order to to cross the trap door to get onto the mother plane to be saved. So you will find a penny a pound for every pound you were over 140 pounds, which was the average weight of the original man.
Now, you know what? To most people in 2015, this sounds like fiction. But this was the reality for millions and a half of us.
Yeah.
And even Muhammad estimated there was probably 1.5 million. So those are the people who really followed that direction, not all of them to some degree. Active temple members, I don't know how many they were. But we certainly followed that and believed that to the letter and to the spirit, and sometimes to the bean soup, bean ice cream extent of the word.
Absolutely.
I want you to listen to Religion Means Alive. We're speaking with Brother Wali Akbar Muhammad, the former editor of the Last Post, former editor of the Muslim Journal. And you can participate in the conversation at 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. I also wanted you, I didn't interrupt you, but I wanted you to explain, because there are a lot of people listening, they may not know the history and the structure of the Nation of Islam is very important. I also want you to finish telling us about, you're now visiting the Temple of Islam, number two, Chicago, as we call the headquarters, and continue on to tell us about that trip.
Okay, so I got, like I said, I went to the temple, and there was a message for me at the temple. I was supposed to see Hassan Sharif. I don't know who Hassan Sharif is. I don't know how to contact this brother. I don't know even how anybody else knows that I'm here in Chicago. So I was, in one sense, curious to see what this brother wanted, and in another sense, I'm saying, you know, maybe I should just maintain my anonymity and you know, not go overboard trying to find this brother. But I did finally call the number that they gave for Hassan Sharif, and there was no answer at the phone, so I felt relieved. And I caught my flight back to D.C., and I carried my film back to D.C., processed my film, and sent the pictures of Elijah Muhammad and from the convention back to Muhammad Speaks overnight. And I sent along with it an application to work there as a photographer. And what happened was Hassan Sharif was the nephew of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He was in charge of an area of public relations and so forth. And they were making a serious effort to keep control of the images of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that folks had. So they collected the film from all the photographers. They took it down to the Muhammad Speaks building, and in the brand new dark room of the Muhammad Speaks building, they were going to process the film, getting ready for the next edition of Muhammad Speaks. And as it turned out, the developer that they used was not the strength that they had expected it to be. So they grouped the film, they developed the film of all the photographers that were there under the control of the Nation, and they came out with no picture. So then there was a gnashing of teeth, so to speak, on the Monday following the convention, because there were no pictures from the convention. And then, by the grace of Allah, the envelope that I prepared and mailed from D.C. came in with photographs, and my photographs were on the cover of the March edition of Muhammad Speaks for 1970. So those are my pictures of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad on the cover. They were doctored a little bit by Eugene Majeed, to take a few of the lines and the wrinkles out. And since I had sent a letter of application and my pictures were the ones that were there, we got a call in D.C. that Wednesday from John Ali telling Dr. Shabazz to get me on a plane out to Chicago so they could evaluate my application. And as it worked out, I went out to Chicago for an interview and wound up staying in Chicago. From that point on, I came back later, I think a month later, and collected my belongings and stuff and moved out there, moved out to Chicago to stay. So then working at the Muhammad Speaks plant, I was also the part-time tour guide. So I got to lead tours around the plant for folks that wanted to visit. And this is when I met Imam Muhammad, or Minister Wallace at that point. He came for a tour of the plant, and I got to spend about an hour with him, going from floor to floor and explaining all the...
What were your impression of him in contrast to the other ministers, such as Minister Lonnie Shabazz? At that time, he'd been known as Minister Lonnie Shabazz. I don't know whether you had met Minister Lewis at that time, but did you know Minister Lewis at that time?
Yeah. I met him when he came. He spoke in D.C.
Yes, sir.
And then, I had been in the Audubon Ballroom the weekend before Malcolm was killed. They had it was either New York Temple or New Jersey Temple that had a big fundraising event in the Audubon Ballroom. Just I think it was the week before. It was a month before Malcolm was killed. So they all use the same ballroom. So I got to meet the son of Thunder. I got to meet Jeremiah. I got to meet Clyde Rockman.
Contrast these ministers with the presence of Minister Wallace D. He was quite different now, but I want you to put it in your own words. I know you met Minister Lucius Biar and Isaiah Kareem, these great historic figures. For the next 10 minutes, try to contrast them and only what a journalist of your caliber could do.
MashaAllah. The man was, first of all, he was the opposite end in terms of humility. He was able to listen.
Are you saying the other ministers were not good listeners?
No. They part of being a minister in the Nation of Islam meant that you had to have a certain degree of I don't want to call it arrogance, because arrogance is not the word. The ministers were not arrogant, but you had to have an elevated air of appreciation for yourself.
I told you that only you, a journalist of your caliber, could do that. In the hands of others, they either slaughter the situation, a mangle of English language in the process of trying to make an accurate description. But you're past the grade, and you're now qualified for the mothership of journalism.
that was almost a requirement, you know, because, well, I mean, we all had something to prove. We had, you know, we'd been ground in the dust. And then to be elevated to the point of enough knowledge to make a fool of yourself, and then you had to 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 represent that knowledge in a way that that showed that you had that knowledge without being overbearing. Now, the older ministers did it in a much different way than the younger ministers. Okay, now, if you were listening to, let's see, Minister Harry X. Craighead was his name. He was a field minister, but he was up in age. Minister Benjamin, who I didn't consider to be up in age, although he was, they didn't have to put on the air of importance. I think we Kashif and I broke it down. That's Gaif Noor Kashif, Imam in D.C. But he was a reporter also. He's the one I learned my journalism from. Now, what we had observed is that the rank and file members and some of the ministers would take on the characteristics of the description that was given to us in the newspaper. So we took on the air that was attributed to us in the media. The fast moving, quick thinking, right down to the modern times. We had a little trot that we did with where you swung your right arm behind you, and you had a rapid step trot that was fast moving, quick thinking.
Right down to the modern times. Check an FYI, brother.
That was us. If you're taller than the man in front of you, move on up.
That's right. And we would say automatic dress right dress.
Yep. So when you the imam had the air of knowing, but at the same time he didn't have to show you that he knew. Now, Jeremiah had to impress. He had his mink hat that he wore, indicated he was the minister. Dr. Shabazz had a certain air, a certain look that went along with his PhD that let you know he was a minister. Who else? Let's see. Jeremiah. Yeah, Jeremiah. Well, Jeremiah had. Well, there was no question about him. Minister George was another one that had to let you know that he was a minister. Minister Lewis. He had a humility about him, but he also had that elevated status. He didn't have to tell you who he was. You saw him on the rostrum and you knew who he was. There was no question. You saw him on the street, you kind of knew who he was. Humble brother was Minister Troy B.R.
Yes.
Another minister that had to let you know he was the minister was Hewlin Shaw.
Yes.
Who would later become
Yahweh
Ben Yahweh.
What about Minister Lucius B.R.?
Minister Lucius, like Minister Benjamin, was another one that had that self-effacing air. He could step back. And to be honest with you, I believe they all learned that from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad himself. Because, I can still remember my first conversation with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I was standing in the hall in his home. Sister Clara was sick, and we were there for just to be present to show our support and well wishes. I was in the hall and in his home, and there he looked over and he said, excuse me, brother. Are you planning on staying for dinner? And, you know, you had to think fast in those days. Now, what do you say to the most powerful black man in America if he asks you, you in his house, he asks you, are you going to stay for dinner? So, by the grace of Allah, I said, well, only if I'm invited, sir. He took another step and he looked over the banister again, called out to one of the sisters in the kitchen. He said, sister, it looks like this brother's going to stay for dinner. Would you get him a cup of coffee? Because it looks like we better start trying to fill him up now. And then he took another step up and he looked over the banister at me and he said, brother, forgive my humor. You're welcome in my home anytime.
Wow. Some of his own children were not necessarily welcome. I understand they had to get permission to stay overnight.
but that kind of an exchange, you know, was what you know, it's sort of what James Baldwin described in his explanation of meeting the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He was being interviewed come editor of Muhammad Speaks and didn't know it.
Most people didn't know that, but I thought the president of General Electric said one of the most influential books in his life was The Fine Next Time, which the bulk of that book is about meeting the Honorable Elijah Muhammad with James Baldwin. So I think this is a very profound personality, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The man had a profound personality. It was quite different. I mean, I never met the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I just only been in his presence when he was speaking. And, of course, all he had to do was get up and say, As-salamu alaykum. And 20,000 men, including people that you were frightened, terrified to be on the streets with 20 years ago, would humbly submit their whole person and spirit to him. So he was quite an unusual person. I like that how you describe the ministers, because I think part and parcel of a people who have been crushed to the ground. And I wish, but before I do that, I want them to tell us, tell our audience how we can get those photographs. They are priceless. They are valuable. They are collector's items, and they're going to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars in the future. So you invest in and buying them, because I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. In the next 5 years, I'm predicting right here, not a prophet, but the 11th of, I think, what is this? This is the 13th of May, 2015. I'm predicting by this time in the next 3 years, Imam Wahdatuddin Muhammad is going to be a household name. I'm predicting that the people will have a resurgence of respect for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So I think what we're doing here now, and this program will eventually be a huge program, whether I'm the host or not. Religion Means Alive is on its way to being a landmark program. I'm telling you, I was at a gathering recently, and I had Christians say, you should be the voice of Islam and love, the faith. And I think what is happening is, we're seeing the rise of a new community. We see an old world going out with a loud noise. What's going on in Baltimore? What's going on in Ferguson? What's going on in New York? The leaders of African America are no longer able to hold our people. The leaders of Muslim African Americans are no longer able to hold our people. So I think we're going to see a new ordering. I think we're going to start seeing mass meetings. I think we're going to have big activities. So I'm going to shut up and let you continue.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this is what we're on the verge of, because the one thing that Islam gives us, it gave us the foundations for during the Nation of Islam time, was the concept of every tub has to stand on its own bottom, you know? And the idea of being self-reliant, the idea of being, because I think the next mass movement within America's minority communities is going to come from individuals who have the strength, the courage, the knowledge, and the faith to stand up for what's right and confront what's wrong. And the only way you're going to find that in African Americans at this point is through their practice of Islam. You know, it's the underlying genetic memory, as C. Eric Lincoln put it, that allows a number of our people to accept to follow that truth and representation of righteousness that came with us from Africa, came with us from Mecca through Africa into this wilderness called North America. And I think there's a level of oppressive mindset that continues in America that has to be confronted by all Americans, not just African Americans, but all Americans. And I think once we reach the point of confronting those ills and those evils, we'll make some progress. But until, and the only faith-oriented opposition is going to come through Islam. Christianity doesn't offer it.
And I also hasten to add, the understanding of Islam by given by Imam Waqi Muhammad. We've seen a lot of forms of Islam that has been in America, and what I've seen with it is it can't attract flies to a dump, and it has no power to transform. Much of what we even seen with the work of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was a cleanup process, a de-plantinization of our people. Our people have been put on the plantation, in many cases made living, and the Nation of Islam was able to de-niggerize us, rehumanize us, bring us back into our nature, renaturalize us, and as a direct result of that, he disposed us from, and therefore to come into El-Islam with an independent mind. I remind our audience that El-Islam, that Bin Laden picked up the Quran, he read it in Arabic. Saddam Hussein picked up the Quran, he read it in Arabic. Dr. Ayman Zahari picked up the Quran and read it in Arabic. But they haven't been able to make heads or tails of the Quran because our nature hasn't been restored. And Almighty God has restored us, our nature, and has given us a profound insight through Imam Waqi Muhammad. I just have to say that. And I want you to continue as we describe Imam Muhammad and more as we have about 20 minutes here. I want you to continue to describe your photographs, talk about each of them. And I'm just going to shut up and sit back and listen and not interrupt my teacher as he guides me into further knowledge. As he stay in the old temple of Islam, therefore I class, Brother Wali Muhammad, who took you further into the program.
So, like I said, I've even while we're speaking now, I'm thinking, of a set of negatives that I have that we're talking about the ministers under Elijah Muhammad. And in 1975, I believe it was right around this time, I think, May or June, I think we had a big ministers' meeting in Chicago. And all of the ministers were there for orientation under Imam Muhammad. And as part of that orientation class, all of these ministers were asked to come to the lower level of what was then Elijah Muhammad Mosque number 2 and sit for a photograph, a portrait. And I recently came upon 4 or 5 rolls of film with those portraits on. I can't remember that. I didn't do the names of all the ministers at that time. And I don't know if we published them in the paper, as I could go back and compare them to. So I think I'm going to put some of them online and ask for some help.
How would we get them online?
Hmm?
How would we get them online?
Oh, just go to the website that I gave earlier, bit.go.
Repeat that website again.
Okay. It's bboyindiattom.ddelta.oscar and put a slash and WDM. Now that will take you to the page for the book on remembering Imam W.D. Muhammad. But that's just one of the pages of the website.
I tried to download that today and haven't been successful in downloading it. Do I have to download it? Will you text me that site again so I can get it?
Okay, what I did was I sent you a link to the book itself because it's
right.
It's too large to email.
Okay, but you will give me the... if you would just text me the site so I can look at it, because we're going to have you back on next week. Will you be available to come back on next week so we can continue this discussion? But I want you to before you do that. Yes. Okay. Continue, my dear brother.
Inshallah. Yeah, I will probably be available next week. Like I said, I'm not at home now. I'm in the home of my daughter and son-in-law in Austin, Texas. So we were here to celebrate Mother's Day. All the men from the family went to my son's home and prepared a meal for the mothers in the family. And then we put on a little theatrical production and then served all the mothers. Let me see, well, how many mothers was it? One,
I hope you brought a memory of your mother, and I want you to tell us a little bit more about your mother, excuse me. You can tell our audience while you about Mother's Day, but I think you have a very fascinating mother who prepared you for this task tonight that you're up to.
Yeah, I wrote a little tribute to my mother from Mother's Day online. I woke up with her on my mind on Mother's Day. And she was quite unique. Both my parents were quite unique. And I think it was really a gift from Allah that put the two of them together. Because my grandparents on my father's side were both slaves, and then on my mother's side, it's her fifth great-grandmother who was the slave child of John Marshall, the son of the first Chief Justice of the United States. But it was really unique. My mother was raised in, who was born in D.C. and raised in Philadelphia. And she was the organist at the church. And she was 16 years old, and she was the organist out in front of the church and announced that she was sweet 16 and had never been kissed. And my father, being the opportunist that he was, overheard her statement and went over and kissed her. And it wasn't too much longer before they were married, and they spent 62 years together as husband and wife. They had 10 children. 5 of us survived and remained. And the thing about it was, my mother was an artist, a musician, an entrepreneur, a mother, a wife, a counselor, a perpetual optimist. I never saw her down or sad or blue. She was a wordsmith, a teacher, and a teacher by example. And at 75 years of age, middle child of my 3 remaining siblings, I'm still recalling those pearls of wisdom that she shared while I was still too young to understand. So you don't get to pick your parents, that's for one thing for sure. But I thank Allah for the both of mine, and I can't imagine how I would have made a better choice on my own. So I was looking at a little bit of TV, craft TV this morning. I saw some handiwork being done on TV that reminded me of some of the creations of my mother. And I got to watch and learn many of those crafts just standing at her knee as a child. I mean, she made the most lifelike artificial flowers that you can imagine. She used some kind of fiber out of Japan and she made roses and carnations that, I mean, they had the touch of reality. Man, I remember. Oh. So, yeah. My mother was quite a person. I saw many of the qualities of my mother in Sister Clara. I saw a similar quality. It was just the reality. You know, my mother's repeated slogan was, "Everything happens for the best." And she, when you talk about making lemonade out of lemon, she was the one that could make lemonade out of anything. Man, I think she could have made lemonade out of a rock if she had to. But I remember moving some items from Elijah Muhammad's home in D.C. when he sold it out to Chicago for him and Sister Clara, and we arrived too late to have dinner with him when we brought the furniture there. And when we got it offloaded and got over to their house, she apologized for us not being able to have dinner with Elijah Muhammad, and bought us dinner at the Salam restaurant, and she paid us the price that we had contracted to bring the furniture out there. And then she gave each of us a $500 tip. And she said, "Now I know that because you were doing this for my husband, that you would give him a price that's not really fair. You'd give him a better price than you would give anybody else. So I'm adding on to the price that you gave him an amount that we think is fair for you to have."
Wow.
So, and then gave us plane tickets back to D.C. We drove a U-Haul out there. And,
you know what?
They paid.
I don't know any first lady I certainly don't know any ministers' wives anywhere in our nation or any first ladies in any church that would have done that. That might have been one, but I just don't know it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just the human quality, the attentiveness to the nature of human beings and how they would act.
And, you know, this is what James Baldwin captures in his essay. It's not captured. The picture we have of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Sister Clara, we don't have much of a portrait of Sister Clara, but a very foreboding figure in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, not a human person. People writing on the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I said, this is not the man. I mean, I've been in the presence of the great preachers of our time, Dr. King. I've been in the presence of most of our great leaders, and I have never met a man in presence. I mean, even on stage, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you could see his humility, especially when he would walk off. You could just see a regular person. So in the theology of time, you got a really regular, humane person, a person that you could imagine your grandfather being like, or you felt grandfatherly. You really did. A grandfather figure. And this is what James Baldwin captured. But, you know, I don't see that in people. I don't even see in the ministers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad presenting the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in that humane way as a man that's walking up the stairs, the man that was a man that you see in the car parked outside of the York supermarket who could convey to you that I'm busy, but yet I respect you. I mean, he would look, you know, I got close to him at the supermarket one time. He was in the parking lot, and whatever he was doing, he was observing. He didn't really want to be bothered or be given an own rush. But at the same time, you know, obviously I wanted to say something to him, but the look he gave me was, yes, my brother, warm and friendly, but I'm busy now. He did not have to convey that. He did not put that in words.
He was capable of doing that. That was...
Yeah.
And that was... I mean, that is...
Yes. And you can't even have a conversation with them. They're quick. I won't name them. I was going to name one of them right now. He's quite controversial. But you just...
The essence of humanity. That was. I think my spookiness left me in the presence of Sister Clara. We were driving through the city downtown near the Capitol on our way to one of the malls in Southeast Washington, and she asked me to slow down. And she said, you know, brother, I think that's the very same bench I used to sit on and feed the squirrels and the pigeons when my husband was in the Library of Congress.
Wow.
Said I would, he told me not to leave the room. It wasn't safe. He said, but I would come out anyway. And I'd sit here with the pigeons and the squirrels and then I'd find my way back before he got home, before he came back from his studies. But again, that shows the humanity. That shows the reality of life. That here she's going to defy her husband's request because of boredom, but at the same time, within the limits of being back so as not to create a problem. So she's going to see to it. That was an element of my mother's existence, is that there were five of us that survived. He lost the first five children in a row. And she would oftentimes cook two or three different dinners because she knew she had children with different, and she always wanted to have something that satisfied each of our tastes. So she wouldn't just cook something that she wanted to cook and say, just eat it or else. She would look to satisfy our personal needs, our personal wants. They weren't needs, they were just wants. But my father would continue to berate us. Just eat whatever your mother cooks. She's not going to poison you. We said, I want this, I want that, I want chicken, I want beef, I want a burger, I want, And she would endeavor to find something to put on that table every day that would satisfy all of us, or each of us, individually, knowing that she had to cook a dinner that would have to satisfy us all collectively. And it's that kind of sentiment, that kind of human sentiment that oftentimes we don't get around to today. Today's life takes us away from those human sentiments, takes us away from the time that it takes to be human or to be sensitive to. And in a sense, that was what Imam Muhammad brought to the followers of Elijah Muhammad, sense of humanity. Although the humanity was there in his parents and was there for those who were close enough to see it or to glimpse it, he was able to bring it into reality. While we had a need during his father's time to have a collective mind, we had to have that in-your-face personality, whereas we had to prove who we were. As he brought us to the sense where we didn't have to push that issue. We didn't have to get in somebody's face. We didn't have to. We had to look more at ourselves as a leader than to pass that responsibility of leadership on to a single individual to hold over us like a sword or like some kind of major authority. We've grown like growing your children. You grow your children up to face. You grow your children up to face the responsibility of life, and then you take pride in their ability to go forward, to solve their own problems, to solve each individual problem, as opposed to having to run back to ask, should I do this way? Should I buy this kind of automobile? Should I purchase this kind of home? Should I get this kind of loan? You raise them to be independent and responsible, and yet to maintain a sense of humanity, a sense of sensitivity to human need. And I'm sure Elijah Muhammad and Clara Muhammad both could look to the efforts of their son and say he achieved that point in life. Not only did he achieve it, he was able to share it with a community that has grown large enough to represent it and continue to share it, to extend that. Uh-oh, am I still talking?
Yes.
Okay. But that's, that's
the... You're still on the air. Brother, when a minister of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, an editor of the Muhammad Speak News, of the Bilalian News, I'm sorry, I'm getting excited to be among the stars, I'm ready to eat one meal every other day myself. To have an attitude of the Muslim girl, a man of your stature, a little country boy from Lynchburg, Virginia, shudders. Virgin Mae Desmond, has son, has entered among the pantheon of stars. And I see myself as a star because I've known enough, have enough sense to follow the greatest star that the world has known since Prophet Muhammad himself, Imam Wasabi Muhammad, and the precursor to that great star, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I said the most honorable, because Allah says that the one who is most honorable is the one who is most thoughtful to his duty. And I don't know of any African American who has been more thoughtful of his duty than the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who brought us to the door of the Messiah. And Imam Muhammad took us up to the minbar to be the teacher. You've been listening to Wali Akbar Muhammad from Washington, D.C., by the way of Chicago. And I don't think it would be inappropriate for him to be anywhere else but in Austin, Texas, the capital of the Lone Star State. And I read that as a powerful sign of Allah, that he's a star in his own right. We are a community of stars. And as our Christian friends would say, soon and very soon, we're going to see a new leadership emerge in America. Thank you. Until next week, Brother Wali Akbar Muhammad. Until next week, our dear beloved audience, we'll see you. Tomorrow, we're going to have Murad Muhammad on. He will be in the ring. Wednesday, we will be on the couch with our brother, Dr. Nazim Rashid. Thursday, we're followed up by F. Carrick. I'm from the great city of Selma, Alabama on Friday. Saturday, we will be live from Philadelphia. Sunday, I hope you all will be with me while we'll be speaking at the Minister Malcolm Shabazz Symposium, Prayer Muhammad School, while he's in Avenue, I believe it's in Philadelphia. Thank you until tomorrow. Thank you, Mr. Akbar Muhammad. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You say in the religion of Islam and the Quranic language, As-salamu alaykum.
As-salamu alaykum.
Yes, sir.
MashaAllah.